Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on September 14th, 2019. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is the seventh of 32 classes on our structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. This talk is on the Sakavabhanga Sutta, which is Sariputta's analysis of the Four Noble Truths. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. So today is the seventh class of our, how many class? 32 class structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into the three marks of existence. This particular sutta is the Sakavabhanga Sutta, an analysis of the Four Noble Truths as presented by Sariputta. As with all these suttas, it gets right to the heart of the matter, but this is a particularly interesting one. Well, I'll offer commentary as I go along. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying in the deer park in Isipatana. He addressed those gathered. Friends, it was here that I set in motion the unexcelled wheel of Dhamma. I mean, this is where he gave his first teaching. My Dhamma cannot be corrupted by any Brahman, Deva, Mara, Brahma, or anyone in the entire world. So he's immediately making a reference to the common beliefs of his time, following priests blindly, or believing that disincarnate beings such as Devas or Mara, which was a common malevolent god during the Buddha's time and still today, or even Brahma himself. Brahma and very briefly, this is not doing it complete justice, Brahma is the Hindu god, much like a Christian god, the god of creation. And it's much more intricate than that in the Hindu teachings, but that's what the Buddha's referring to. It has nothing to do with any of that. And as far as the Buddha's Dhamma is concerned, all of that is a corruption. And people get all upset about when I say or the Buddha said those things, but that's all that he's talking about. In relation to his Dhamma, it's simply something different. It's just like saying that a doctor who wants to learn how to do appendectomy is not going to get much benefit of going to brain surgery school. It's kind of a silly example, but that's the point. You can only learn what you're actually studying. And the Buddha's Dhamma is meant to be directly experienced, as we all know. It's not based on any beliefs or abstract ideologies. Or anyone in the entire world. No one can corrupt the revelation, the declaration, the description, the structure, the explanation, and the clear and direct teaching of Four Noble Truths. And then he describes them. The first noble truth is a noble truth of stress and suffering. The second noble truth is a noble truth of the origination of stress and suffering. The third noble truth is the noble truth of the cessation of stress and suffering, dukkha. And the fourth noble truth is a noble truth of the eightfold path of practice leading to the cessation of stress, of dukkha. The reason why I say that in order to actually practice the Buddha's Dhamma, everything he teaches must be understood in the context of dependent origination, what he awakened to, and this is the whole, the Four Noble Truths are the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma. The Buddha describes profound or awakened right view as a view that understands stress completely, has a complete comprehension of the nature of stress. That right view understands the origination of stress, craving for and clinging to fabricated beliefs that are ignorant of Four Noble Truths. Right view is a view that has actually experienced the cessation of dukkha. You know it, you've had the experience of it, and right view is established in the path leading to, the Eightfold Path leading to the cessation of stress and suffering. Or another way of saying that, the cessation of stress and suffering is based on understanding Four Noble Truths. Is that clear? This description of Four Noble Truths, does you feel like it's beyond any of you to understand that? Does anybody, honestly, does anybody feel like they can't understand Four Noble Truths? Yes, no?
No.
And that's the whole Buddha's Dhamma. So the reason why I'm saying that is in your practice, and it's going to happen for almost everyone, you'll be frustrated, and at times you'll have great doubt, and you'll feel like, well, this is just beyond me. I don't understand it. I don't know where I'm going. Think back to the simple sutta and these simple explanations. This is what the Buddha is asking us to understand. And it's completely achievable by any human being. It doesn't take any special merit. It doesn't take any special level of intelligence. It doesn't take any special teachers. It just means that it takes right effort in developing the Eightfold Path. The Buddha continues, friends, associate with wise disciples such as Sariputta and Moggallana. Sariputta and Moggallana are well-trained, focused, wise, and sympathetic to those developing a life integrated with the Eightfold Path. That last is so important. A teacher that's not sympathetic with you actually developing the Dhamma is not going to be of much use within the Dhamma. Sariputta is like a, these two lines are just wonderful. Sariputta is like a mother giving birth. That's what I was referring to later. In the beginning of practice, but even as teaching a complete practice, Sariputta is the one. Sariputta is like a mother giving birth to the Dhamma. And Moggallana is like the nurse that attends to the baby.
Was that sometimes translated as wet nurse?
I don't know if I've ever seen. I may have, but I don't remember ever seeing it that way. But
does that make perfect sense? That the nurse attending, we don't have that anymore, but there used to be this whole institution of women going around and being the one who fed, her own breast milk, the baby.
Yeah, it could certainly fit that.
Yeah.
Because, again, the implication is that Sariputta can give you the broad strokes and get you going in the right direction, and those that need a little bit more introspective insight, Moggallana is the one. Yeah. And then, since this is a basic tip, well, you'll see how this plays out.
Giving sustenance to the
Sariputta trains others on developing the Dhamma, Moggallana to the highest culmination. I'm going to skip over some commentary. Sariputta is able to declare, teach, describe, set forth, reveal, explain, and make plain the Four Noble Truths in detail. So if you're wondering if you're interested in developing what the Buddha taught, a good way to find a teacher is, can they do this? This is the Buddha clearly states, this is what a Dhamma teacher should be able to do. Teach, describe, set forth, reveal, explain, and make plain Four Noble Truths in detail. The reason why I'm saying that is I spent about 350 years in Buddhism, it doesn't matter, a lot of years. I can't add it up in my head right now. Studying in many of the foremost, especially on the East Coast, monasteries and centers, and then doing quite a bit of traveling, studying with some incredibly sincere and wonderful people and a few crazies. And in all that time, I hardly ever heard, even in passing, Four Noble Truths or an Eightfold Path. In other words, these were dozens and dozens of so-called Buddhist teachers, and not one of them ever taught me anything like this. Anything, especially this teaching. And here's the Buddha's qualification for a Dhamma teacher.
Even in the Theravadan
Yeah. Very rarely is it. Modern Theravadan Buddhism is basically the Vipassana movement with some minor variations. Mm. So in the early days, but even going back to the third and the fourth Buddhist council, this is 300 and 400 years after the Buddha's passing, many years ago, there was still a move away from that and getting into the more mystical aspects of Buddhism as fabricated in the Abhidhamma. The Theravadans, almost right from the beginning, relied on the Abhidhamma rather than the suttas. And of course, that's why they created it, too. That's why they put it together. It's a good question. Thank you. Having said these words, the Buddha left for the day's abiding. Sariputta then addressed those gathered. Friends, it was here that the Tathagata set in motion the unexcelled wheel of Dhamma. This Dhamma cannot be corrupted by any Brahman, Deva, Mara, Brahma, or anyone in the entire world. No one can corrupt the revelation, the declaration, the description, the structure, the explanation, and the clear and direct teaching of the Four Noble Truths. Excuse me. He's repeating what his teacher said, but he's repeating it for emphasis. This is an important point. The setting, obviously, well, not obviously, it doesn't take a lot of speculative thought to realize that he's speaking to a general group and not likely a group of well-seasoned practitioners. much like the Kalama Sutta, it's probably a lot of locals and the original Sangha, but he's getting right to the heart of the matter, because the people he's talking to are engaged in all these different types of practices, much like most people are today. Modern Buddhism, and the reason why I call it Buddhism by common agreement, is it's like the Chinese menu. You take a little bit from column A, column B, column C, D, etc. Take a few little things from this teacher, that saying, cobble it together and create your own Buddhist practice and call it Buddhism. And that is encouraged by almost everyone today. There's this great big smorgasbord of almost an infinite number of contradictory teachings. So there's no way to reconcile all those together anymore. Nobody could say it's all one thing. So now the common refrain is pick a little bit here, pick a little bit there, and you'll have a Buddhist practice. The Buddha said 2,600 years ago, please don't do that, because it's just constant distraction. You'll only continue your own ignorance. If you're interested in the Dhamma, find someone that can teach it. Then Sariputta reiterates the Four Noble Truths. The noble truth of stress and suffering, the noble truth of the origination of stress, the noble truth of the cessation of stress, and the noble truth of the Eightfold Path of practice leading to the cessation of stress. Sariputta continues. Friends, what is the noble truth of stress and suffering? So if anybody's wondering, what are we here to understand about stress? And again, when I first started reading the suttas, the thing that was most shocking and continued a little bit of my frustration was how simple and direct the Buddhist teaching work is, and how far I was led away from that. And I'm not blaming other people. It was my choice to follow fabricated beliefs, because it was allowing me to maintain ignorant views of myself while seemingly doing something to end those ignorant views. Of course, I was studying something that couldn't deliver that. What is the noble truth of stress and suffering? Birth is stressful. Right off the bat, this is the first thing the Buddha always said. What he's saying is not having a birth, a physical birth, is stressful. None of us can remember that. He's saying that simply as a consequence of having a human life, there is stress. He immediately, and if we can truly understand that one sentence in its most profound example, we've achieved the goal. We right view, understand stress. But it means that we've completely depersonalized stress. We understand that simply as a consequence of human life, having this human life, I'm going to have stress in my life, and none of it is personal. None of it. From the minute of physical birth to physical death, all of that intervening minutes, days, weeks, months, years, nobody knows how long it's going to be, none of it is personal. And how can it be? Listen to the rest of the description. Sickness is stressful. Aging is stressful. Death is stressful. The Buddha simply pointing out, again, having a human life is stressful. It just is. Our minds want to start picking at that almost immediately. Wait a minute. Sickness is personal, and we might start thinking this way. But of course, it's just the experience of being sick. Oftentimes, we wonder, why did this befall me? As if it actually was this, one of us just didn't make it because they had a cold this morning. We can easily take that personal. Of course, it isn't. Nothing is. There's not one thing that we can find in the world that happens to people that happens to them personally. Sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair are all stressful, all part of having a human life. Not getting what is desired is stressful. If anybody has an argument with these, I'm serious. Anybody doesn't see this clearly, maybe argument was wrong, please let me know. Receiving what is undesired is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful. The five clinging aggregates are form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications, and consciousness, meaning ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, not some grand cosmic consciousness. Those five clinging aggregates are the Buddha's description of the personal ongoing experience of suffering. And if you look at yourself from a measure of well-concentrated mind and framed by the Eightfold Path, you'll realize that's what you describe yourself by clinging these aggregates together and calling it you. When the point of calling these the five clinging aggregates, another word for them would be anatta, the not self characteristic. You can stretch it a little bit and say that this is karma unfolding. The five clinging aggregates describe the ongoing personal experience of ignorance of Four Noble Truths. I cling to this form as me. I cling to my feelings to describe myself, to myself and to me and the world around me. I insist that the perceptions that I've developed rooted in ignorance are true, no matter how much difficulty they may be bringing in my life. And the fabrications are hardened constructs formed by those perceptions. And now those fabrications that I have identified as me, I am compelled to cling to because it's who I think I am. And that's all supported by the fifth aggregate of thinking, ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. So again, look at those five aggregates. That's what we all use to describe ourselves to ourselves.
So I just want to make sure I understand this. If somebody is coming at you physically or
sending you
a nasty tweet, it's not personal because it's on them for acting that way.
Yeah. And I was smiling because I think it was the very first retreat, Brett, and you might even remember this, although it was 6 years ago. I think it was just after I taught the Anatta-Lakana, the teaching on not self. And I could see as I was reading the sutta, this person was getting rather agitated and they couldn't wait to get to the, and they were actually studying, I found out later, they were studying a certain modern teacher online on their electronic device. All that's fine. They were getting very agitated by this idea. And so finally I caught him and he was literally shaking. He says, I'm trying to follow you. What do you do if you're standing on a train track and a train is coming at you? You take two steps to the right. Hello, Maura. Aren't you online?
It was in my pocket when I was driving.
Oh. Well, welcome. Glad you made it. His idea was, and influenced by modern Buddhism, that there's no such thing as a self, so why even worry about it? Well, that's not what the Buddha teaches. In fact, the Buddha teaches that our individual human life is, and just to use the word, is the most sacred thing we have, meaning it's the most important thing, because it is this human life that we have the opportunity to awaken. That's why. Not because it's given by God or anything else like that. Maybe it is. That's not the point. We have a human life that right now holds the potential to awaken. That's what's most important. And that, and this all revolves, the reason why I'm creating a great emphasis on this point, that everything resolves within anatta, within where we're experiencing the results of ignorance, is where the five clinging aggregates reside too. In short, these unresolved issues of ignorance are resting right here, right now, in our moment-by-moment life. Maura, you can sit up front if you want.
I forgot there were seats there. I'm good right here. I like being overlooking everything.
You just don't want to get too close, that's all.
You're elevated.
I am.
The Buddha always warned against sitting on high seats.
Oh, yeah, he did.
And sleeping on high beds.
Yes.
But Maura, you've been the exception to so many rules. Sariputta continues. Again, these simple explanations of things that we should know about, but we're so rooted in ignorance that we don't even recognize the significant aspect of ignorance is the compulsive need to continue to ignore its own ignorance. And those are these strategies that we create to just do that. So here again, being hit right between the eyes. What is birth? Whatever takes birth, the descent, the coming to be, the coming forth, the arising of the five clinging aggregates, excuse me. This is such a key teaching right here on the Buddha's meaning of birth. It has nothing to do, I won't say that. It has almost nothing to do with physical birth, because the Buddha's teaching is, don't be concerned about physical birth and what might transpire even before that or influence it or any of that. The reason why that's completely insignificant is you're here now. It doesn't matter where you came from. It's just as foolish to try to figure out the creation of the cosmos culminating in me in this moment as any other fabrication. For one thing, you can't know it, but that's just all that thought process that you might go through to bring yourself into a resolution of who I am right now is a distraction. If you want to know who you are right now, calm your mind and take a look. And that's the only way we can know. That's the essence of the Buddha's Dhamma. develop a well-concentrated mind to support the framework of the Eightfold Path so you can see what you are. And so you can see also see what you aren't and stop dragging what you aren't around with you. That's the nature of stress. Is that clear to everyone, by the way? Mm-hmm. Please say no. You can't shake your head because I can't see you shaking your head. If it's not, please say no. And again, this all resolves in this thing called anatta or the five clinging aggregates. The fabrication, I got to go back to it, so now it's out of context. The descent, the coming to be, the coming forth, the arising of the five clinging aggregates, the fabrication of sensuous realms of diverse beings. The fabrication of sensuous realms of that. What the Buddha is saying right there is believing in any type of speculative, non-physical reality. The fabrication of sensuous realms of diverse beings. That's included in the beginning description of stress and suffering. And yet, from the well before the Buddha's time, during the Buddha's time, and continuing for 2,600 years, the great majority of so-called Buddhist teachings is taught to create a speculative establishment for the five clinging aggregates, directly contradicting what the Buddha taught. And the reason why the Buddha taught it is it was so common then. It is the perfect scheme, the perfect strategy for a mind rooted in ignorance that also wants to engage in some type of so-called spiritual or religious practice, to engage in that practice while continuing to ignore its own ignorance. In other words, it's built into the practice and it works very well that way. I don't mean this to sound as a condemnation of everything else except what the Buddha taught. I'm only talking about if you want to develop the Buddha's Dhamma, it takes this type of focus to do that. And that's what he's talking about here. This simple description of what of the descent rooted in ignorance is just that. And again, it has nothing to do with creation myths or past or future birth. It has to do exactly with what it says here. What are we giving birth to in this moment? This is called birth. Skip over some of my commentary. That's a lot of commentary. It is brilliant, so I ask you to read it when you get a chance. And now the Sariputta asks the rhetorical question, what is aging? Aging is, in parentheses, increasing decrepitude. I know a bit about that. Brokenness. I got that too. Graying, no more. Wrinkling, yeah. Decline of the life force, yeah, it's coming. Diminishing of mental faculties, I'll leave that up to you. Of diverse beings. This is called aging. Of diverse meaning simply means this process happens to every human being. And again, is there anything personal in any of this? And is there anything that I can do about it? That's another important question that the Buddha would ask. If you aren't in control of it, it's not you. How could it be you? So I can engage in all kinds of intricate strategies to avoid sickness and believe that I can avoid aging and that I can avoid death. What pops to mind right now, just as an example, is Howard Hughes, this incredibly brilliant man that thought himself to the point where he couldn't leave his hotel room because he was so afraid of getting sick, without realizing in his brilliant mind that everybody gets sick. And within reason, you take precautions. But other than that, you live your life. And everybody ages and everybody dies. And again, when we ignore that, we're like Bahia before he met the Buddha. I won't tell the whole story. If we don't understand that the next moment could be our last, why even bother with doing something like awakening, like taking to the Dhamma? But when we understand that this is the most important thing we can do in our life, no matter what. And again, it doesn't mean that if we have families or ourselves to support, you still go to work. You still do what you have to do. But you engage in the Dhamma and awaken. You get one shot to do it. This is called aging. And what is death? Death is the passing away, the breaking up, the disappearance, the completion of time, the casting off of the body, the interruption of the life faculty, and the dissolution of the five clinging aggregates of diverse beings. This is called death. There's probably a question arising in your minds. Like, isn't he talking about life after death? And I'm not, but I'll get to it. It's addressed later on in this sutta. And what is sorrow? Sorrow is the sadness. Sorrow is sadness, this suffering of misfortune, being touched by pain. This is called sorrow. And what is regret? Regret is the grieving, the crying, the weeping, the wailing, the regret of suffering from misfortune, of being touched by pain. This is called regret. And what is pain? Pain is bodily pain, bodily discomfort, pain or discomfort from bodily contact. This is called pain. And what you'll see the difference that he's describing between that and mental pain. And what is distress? Distress is mental pain and mental discomfort. Pain or discomfort from mental contact. So the Buddha's given these equal weight, isn't he? The physical pain of, say, cancer, or the mental pain of ongoing distraction by my need to continually establish myself in this world. They're equal pains and they're equal distractions. Is Maura still here?
I am.
Oh, okay.
I have a question, but I'm trying to write it down to not interrupt things. And
are you ready for the question?
No.
Okay.
I have a question on everything and being
Maura.
Quiet.
And what is distress? Distress is mental pain and mental discomfort, pain or discomfort from mental contact. This is called distress. And what is despair? Despair is despondency and desperation of anyone suffering from misfortune or touched by a painful thing. This is called despair. And what is the stress of not getting what is desired? And those being subject to birth, meaning they've already established themselves in ignorance in the world, the wish arises, may I not be subject to birth? May birth not come to me? Meaning giving birth to another moment rooted in ignorance is the important thing. You're wishing that somehow you don't continue to think and feel this way. Of course, it's just a wish. And Sariputta addresses that. Wishing does not bring cessation. We can want something all we want. If our thinking is still ignorant of Four Noble Truths, wishing is going to bring us nothing. In fact, Brent and I talked a little bit about this earlier. Another word for wishing would be craving or grasping. And when that occurs during Dhamma practice, and it will to every one of us, that's the motivation to abandon the Buddha's Dhamma and seek for something more, because it's, in the moment, it's not giving you what you want. That's one of the hindrances would be doubt. And the reason why the Buddha talks about that, despite the modern way of dealing with doubt, which we should embrace, but doubt and cultivate doubt, the Buddha simply said, recognize doubt and get rid of it, because it'll knock you off your practice. Wishing does not bring cessation. This is the stress of not getting what is desired. Furthermore, an uninformed human being, subject to birth, sickness, aging, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair, the wish arises, oh, may I not be subject to birth, sickness, aging, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. May these not befall me. Has any of you ever felt like that when misfortune came your way? You wish it wasn't happening to you? Do you see that as taking it personal now?
Yes.
This is not me. This is not mine. This is not what I am.
So, John, there's a difference, right? Because this has been described a million times in a million classes, but the common vernacular of taking it personal, like, why did it happen to me, is a little different than just that there's, so, like, one might not have the thought, this, why did this happen to me? But even thinking, this is happening to me and I don't like this, is taking it personal.
Oh, of course it is, yeah.
Right, so mm-hmm. it's, do you understand the distinction that I'm making?
I am in what you're saying, and the whole point of the Buddha's Dhamma is just that, though, to stop
Correct.
Taking things personally. And not even, it's not even to stop taking, it's to recognize, not to stop taking things personally,
that,
recognize that you are taking things
correct.
Personally.
I think that's, so sometimes, as I said, in common vernacular, like, it seems like, oh, you're taking it personally because you think, but maybe I've always tried to understand that subtle distinction that it's just letting go of the fact that it's happening to me, period.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. It's the not taking it personal.
Yeah.
Because it can't be happening to me.
How could
that's
it?
That's a continuation of suffering right there.
Yeah, and it does take a little bit more, it takes a deeper understanding of the context of the Buddha's Dhamma and the things that he's actually taught to really understand that.
Yeah.
You know, but that's, the, in other words, we're going to get to this a little bit later on, and not today, in another sutta, the Dhatu Abhanga Sutta, where the Buddha describes a human being. You know, contrary, again, the belief that there's no such thing as a self or a human being, he taught it directly. A human being is made up of the four physical properties, earth, wind, fire, and water, the fifth property of space. Those four properties need something to manifest in, correct? We need a space. And the sixth property of consciousness. That's it. And when you look clearly at all of us, including ourselves, there's nothing else you can add to that to describe a human being. Nothing. You can say, well, this human being made a lot of money and bought a lot of cars, and this human being was a great golfer, and this human being did this, and this human, those have nothing to do with that underlying aspect of humanity. There's nothing we can change about that. And in those six properties, there's nothing that can affect those six properties in a personal way.
But the ignorant person that was driving around this week definitely felt like it was happening to them.
Yeah, and being able to recognize that is so important, isn't it, Maura? Because then even if you've reacted already to a situation and you understand the framework of the Dhamma, you can bring your mind back to what's occurring. In fact, you can say you've lost your mind. This is a way to bring your mind back into what's occurring. Just real, and again, it's that simple. This is not me. This is not mine. Anytime we find ourselves agitated or distracted in any way, and agitation could be a fake type of happiness that we've gotten something we've been looking to get, it's still a distraction. Recognize this is not me. This is not mine. And you'll immediately, for one thing, you're practicing the Dhamma in that moment, and you'll immediately start diminishing the effects of the reaction, the stress. You immediately start diminishing the cortisol response, the actual physical response in your body, too, simply by calming yourself down.
Abandoning, clinging, and craving in that moment.
Yep. May these not befall me. These things are not avoided by wishing. This is the stress of not getting what is desired. And what are the five clinging aggregates that continue stress? The clinging to form aggregate. The clinging to feeling aggregate. And I mean, that's, those two are the biggest ones, aren't we? For one thing, we think that this physical body is me, and in some way I find it inadequate. So there's a problem right there. And you'll see even the Buddha's description later on in this, how wonderfully well, or Sariputta nails that. And let me continue this. And the clinging to the feeling aggregate, how often do we, in fact, we do it continually, don't even realize it, but we base our own perception of the quality of our life on how we're feeling. And from the minute we're born, if we're observant and don't take things personal, we'll realize how fleeting every feeling is. And to base my own well-being on how I'm, on an arbitrary feeling, when that feeling is itself informed by ignorance, is about the most foolish thing any human being could be when you understand it. Of course, if we don't understand it, we simply continue to do it. That's the understanding that the Buddha teaches.
It's one of the most difficult things to point out to others, that they're causing all this trouble because they're taking their feelings as being very important to them.
Yes, and unfortunately, the only person who has to understand that is me.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why I say that is the whole idea of the Bodhisattva vow, that something that the Buddha never taught, is just that, that once everybody else has got it all together, then I'll be good to go.
Yeah.
The Buddha referred to that as when I was an unawakened Bodhisattva, because he understood the foolishness of that idea. And there's different variations of it. But the point of it is not that the Buddha never saw himself as a savior or his teaching as salvific. So it's not that the world has to change and understand this, because by the Buddha's descriptions, that's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least it's not the point. The point is for an individual, for me to understand what the world is all about, so I stop reacting to it, and I'm able to establish and maintain a calm and peaceful mind no matter what's occurring in the world, inside or outside. Another way of saying it is developing a conflict-free mind. The clinging to feeling aggregate, the clinging to perception aggregate, the clinging to fabrication aggregate, and the clinging to consciousness aggregate. Again, the use of the aggregate is these are five separate parts that we cling together and describe a self and describe our experience. We live within these five clinging aggregates. And these five clinging aggregates are what? Are stress and suffering. These are the five clinging aggregates that continue stress. This, friends, is a noble truth of stress. And what is a noble truth of the origination of stress? This very craving that makes for becoming becoming further. Excuse me, I just got to make that correction. It's not working. Further ignorant. I have father ignorant. That's probably not what I mean to say. Craving and clinging to passion and delight. And tranced here and there with craving for sensuality, craving for continued becoming further ignorant, craving for non-becoming. Many people have so misinterpreted that because they don't understand the context. Craving for not becoming is not craving for a non-physical existence or craving for escape from the physical world. The Buddha is pointing out the foolishness of craving for speculative existences. For speculative non-physical existences, such as there's one particular lineage, and I can't remember the number anymore. I think it was 180,000 full prostrations. That you start your Dhamma practice with 180,000 full prostrations, and after you complete that, and that doesn't mean one after another, you got years to do it. Once you do that, then you can start your Buddha practice, your Buddhist practice. Of course, that's all based on merit. And that you need to do something first as a sign of faith, where the Buddha said, there's none of that here.
Yeah, and what did that practice look like after you did all those frustrations?
Yeah, you probably got a dirty nose and dirty knee and everything. Again, what does it look like? When I came across that, my first thought was, wow, that's pretty good. I can do that. And then I realized, wait a minute, who's going to do the counting here?
Is that what you're talking about, John? That replace the Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path.
In that particular lineage, there is no talk of Eightfold Path or any
of rituals instead of the teaching.
It's all of that, and really it's more of a show of your beliefs rather than actual developing an understanding. And again, that's fine. This isn't what is in a particular Tibetan lineage. And I wish, I said this before, I wish I could be a Tibetan Buddhist because they have the greatest temples, they have the greatest clothes and other robes, they got those great big hats and those long horns. It's really, I'm not kidding.
It's a grand show.
And I really was clinging to the idea of being a Tibetan Buddhist. I took my vows in this particular lineage and I quickly disavowed them because I realized it's a wonderful religion.
Never got to wear the hat.
I never got to wear the hat or blow the horn. Interesting enough, I never got to meditate with any of them either, because they don't.
Yeah.
Even though they talk about it, it's another story. Again, I'm not putting them down. They're all wonderful people. I still consider the teacher I had, a root guru, not that he's had that great influence on my life. He was just such a wonderful man, and I still hold him dearly. Didn't teach me anything. Let me continue. This is called a noble truth of the origination of stress. And what, friends, is a noble truth of the cessation of stress? If you want to understand what this means. The renunciation, the relinquishment, the release, the letting go, the remainderless fading away and complete cessation of craving. This is called a noble truth of the cessation of stress. So where does craving originate in? If you look at dependent origination, it's the sixth step from ignorance. From ignorance as a requisite condition comes fabrications. From fabrications comes that consciousness, ongoing thinking rooted in that ignorance, step by step by step to craving. We want to eliminate craving, we eliminate its source, ignorance. And what is the noble truth of the path of Dhamma practice that leads directly to the cessation of stress? This path is a noble eightfold path. So this is an opportunity for here Sariputta or the Buddha or any other practitioner. Sariputta was just like the Buddha. He studied all of the major so-called religions and spiritual disciplines of his time before he ended up with the Buddha. So he could easily had maintained an attachment because of the effort he put in learning these and the associations he made with these other types of practices. But yet he said, this is it. This way is the Eightfold Path. And there's no ambiguity about that. And again, when I read this for the first time, I think, oh, how could I have been a Buddhist practitioner for so long and nobody mentioned this? And then he describes it. Right view. Right view is knowledge with regard to stress. Knowledge with these relates directly to the Four Noble Truths. Knowledge with regard to stress, knowledge with regard to the origination of stress, knowledge with regard to the cessation of stress, knowledge with regard to the Eightfold Path of practice leading to the cessation of stress. This is right view. So again, if we have any mystical or magical notions about what the Buddha is teaching and what right view might encompass, right view encompasses an understanding of Four Noble Truths. That's it. It's the most significant and powerful teaching, I believe, that humanity has ever been given, because the resolution of understanding what a self is a cessation of all conflict within our minds. And when there's no conflict within my mind, within me, there's no conflict outside of me either. Some of you are thinking, what about all the awful stuff that's happening, even though you're going along your merrily awakened way? It's not a disengaged type of understanding. In fact, the common peace comes from, as Ram alluded to just a little earlier, it comes from understanding the nature of conflict in the world. Even that isn't personal. Even when we might have a person or a group of people insisting on doing something that we object to, and we think it might even be the end of the world in some way, we understand it's all rooted in ignorance. And it's just another example of it. And since we don't react anymore to ignorance within ourselves or out in the world, we simply are calm and at peace. We learn the significant difference between acceptance and approval. That's an awakened human being. An awakened human being no longer feels the need to approve or disapprove of what's occurring. And an awakened human being, such as where we're going, such as the Buddha, accept things in a radical way. Why? It's what occurred. Why lose your mind over something that has already happened? Or why lose your mind over thinking that you are speculating may happen? Bring your mind into your body, into what's occurring, into your life as your life unfolds, and there is peace and understanding, no matter what's occurring. And remember, the Buddha didn't live in a vacuum either. He didn't live disengaged from the world at all. In fact, he was more engaged in the world post his awakening than during his search, and even when he was a prince in his father's kingdom, because all the different leaders came to the Buddha for advice, and he gave them advice. He gave them realistic advice. And what the point I'm making is that when a local king came to the Buddha and said, I need to go over, get that next town and conquer them because of this and because of that, the Buddha didn't say, oh, you're evil. You can never hurt anybody. You should just think positive thoughts. He understood what was going to occur. And it'd be foolish to say, don't do something that you knew was inevitably going to happen. What he did was he counseled these leaders on what to do when you won, which was treat the people that you vanquish fairly. Take care of their needs. And even simple things like don't overtax them, he would teach them, because it's cruel. He taught a completely realistic way of living in the world, rather than throwing up his hands and saying, everything you're thinking about is wrong, even if it's true, because he knew it was unrealistic to expect someone to go from that way of thinking to something that is much more peaceful. But along the way, excuse me, by meeting people where they are, rather than where he would, rather than teach an abstraction of where you should be, meaning you're a bad person but be a good person, he met people where they are. And so that allowed them to simply either follow what he's doing in a specific way or gain a real interest in why is this man teaching this way. And the best example I know of that, there's hundreds and thousands of them still continuing to this day. By the way, still continuing in this room, changing the way we think. the greatest historical example is King Ashoka, who was one of the most bloodthirsty leaders the world has ever seen. If you ever heard that saying, the head on a pike, King Ashoka started that. When he would take over and conquer a town or an area, he would cut people's heads off and stick them up on a post, and you'd see heads all over as far as you could see, to put fear into people's hearts and minds. King Ashoka's here. Once he came across the Buddha's teaching, developed the Eightfold Path, and had his awakening experience, he never harmed another soul. And he went so far as to develop something that we can't figure out today. He started universal health care 2,300 years ago. He even went so far as to start universal veterinary care. Think about that. This man, who was the most bloodthirsty human being who ever lived, came to the Dhamma, changed the way his thinking, and never harmed another soul, and encouraged other people in that very gentle way. There's still rock edicts all over India that have King Ashoka, once he awakened, sent people out all over northern India and then down into Sri Lanka to carve these teachings on rocks so they'd be preserved forever. They're still around today. Okay, sorry about that little. Number two, right intention. Right intention is maintaining mindfulness of the intention for renunciation, for freedom from ill will, for harmlessness, for cessation. This is right intention. That's our intention for developing a Dhamma. Right speech. Anybody not understanding what right speech is? It's right here. Right speech is abstaining from lying, abstaining from divisive speech, abstaining from abusive speech, and abstaining from gossip and idle chatter. This is right speech. And this also relates to the speech, and probably more importantly, the internal dialogue, the speech that we have with ourselves. It's a little bit easier to recognize wrong speech when it's outside of ourselves, projected onto other people. It's much more difficult, but much more significant, to recognize the wrong speech, the wrong idle chatter we have within ourselves. In fact, you could say that's the whole point of meditation, to recognize when we're stuck in that idle chatter and simply come back to our breath. And that simple act of interrupting that ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance does just that. It interrupts that ongoing process. It's the reason why the Buddha taught a concentration practice and nothing else. Right action. Right action is abstaining from taking life, abstaining from stealing, and abstaining from sexual misconduct. This is right action. Right livelihood. Right livelihood is when a skillful disciple of the noble ones has abandoned dishonest livelihood and provides for themselves with honesty. This is right livelihood. When I first came across the Eightfold Path, I was wondering, why did the Buddha have right livelihood there right after right speech and right action? Isn't it covered? And a little bit more investigation, and then looking at the world a little bit, the Buddha recognized that otherwise good and honest men and women, when it took time to put food on a table and feed their kids, feed their family, they might not be quite so honest. And he made the point, look at it here too. There's no aspect of our lives that we can hide the Dhamma from or hide the Dhamma from ourselves. In fact, if we are not willing to do that one thing, it's not a sevenfold path, it's an eightfold path. And I mean, I knew a lot of people when I was in business, and even today, I know a lot of people who are very, very honest people, except when it came to business. And there it was almost justified, this whole bottom line mentality that, you know, the profit means everything. You know. Does it?
Even when he, in right action, when he specifically mentions sexual misconduct, that too is a very powerful driver, driven by ignorance. One of the most powerful things that happens to us.
Yeah, that's right. And again, the Buddha didn't, you know, only if you're taking vows in a monastic community, do you take vows of celibacy? Mm-hmm. What he's saying is that even in your sexual relations, to practice the Dhamma, which basically means to be generous, you know, isn't it? I mean, isn't that the underlying aspect of not being stuck on a self and self-referential views is a natural way of being generous. And so it flows into our sexual relationships too.
And do no harm.
Yeah, rather than looking at that as something that's me, hard not to do that initially. It's an aspect of giving, isn't it? And it should be. Makes it more fun. Take that from a Buddhist teacher. This is right livelihood. Right effort. Right effort is when a skillful disciple of the noble ones internally generates the skillful desire, who is persistent, who remains mindful of their intent for the non-arising of unskillful qualities that have yet arisen. I mean, again, a lot of words. It simply means that we're now being mindful of abandoning those things that would otherwise keep us on that road of ignorance that have yet arisen. Who remains mindful of their intent for abandoning of unskillful qualities that have arisen. Again, we're given the Eightfold Path to know what those qualities are. He doesn't teach us to, Sariputta, the Buddha doesn't teach us to analyze it or embrace it in any way or to continue self-identification with any of these qualities. Recognize them and simply abandon them, let them go. Who remains mindful for maintaining non-confusion and for increasing, developing, and the culmination of skillful qualities that have yet arisen. This is right effort. Is anybody confused about what right effort is? No?
No.
And if you ever do, there it is, right there. Right mindfulness. Right mindfulness is when a skillful disciple of noble ones remains mindful of the body in and of itself while remaining ardent, alert, and mindful of putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. Again, it simply means in our interactions with the people and the events of our lives. Right mindfulness is when a skillful disciple of the noble ones remains mindful of feelings in and of themselves while remaining ardent, alert, and mindful of putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. That last line, in and of themselves, it simply means we leave our feelings alone. We leave the events of our lives alone. In and of themselves, that they're discrete, they're separate from us. It has nothing to do. It's not in and of myself. It's in and of themselves. Is that clear? Because that's such an important line. And it, again, it's another one of those lines that are misunderstood. Ardent, alert, and mindful, putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. Right mindfulness is when a skillful disciple of the noble ones remains mindful of thoughts in and of themselves while remaining ardent, alert, and mindful of putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world. This also directly relates to the beginning of the Satipatthana Sutta, where the Buddha teaches to do this during our meditation practice. Well, and the verbiage that you hear me say in the guidance towards our meditation is when feelings and thoughts arise and pass away, we simply come back to the sensation of breathing. That's a concentration practice. This is the Sariputta is referring to it here too, by not being distracted by our feelings and thoughts. So as we develop that concentration in meditation, we're then able to take it off our cushions and not react off our cushions to feelings and thoughts. At least start beginning to develop a way of recognizing when we're distracted by our own thoughts. Lost my spot, sorry. Mindful of the present quality of mind in and of itself while remaining ardent, alert, and mindful of putting aside greed and distress with reference to the world, this is right mindfulness. Right meditation. Right meditation is when a skillful disciple of the noble ones has established seclusion from sensuality and unskillful mental qualities. They enter and remain in the first jhana. We're gonna have a few more classes on jhana, but remember we went through this just a few months ago. This is what the Buddha teaches is the purpose of meditation is jhana. Jhana meditation. We use meditation for increasing concentration. This description is simply the common experience of what occurs during meditation, and it's only taught to recognize. In other words, these different levels of jhana aren't something to grasp after or to achieve. They're simply there to recognize that our meditation practice is bearing fruit. Excuse me. This first jhana is experienced as rapture born of that very seclusion. It is accompanied by directed thought and evaluation. My comments here. This first jhana is simply the initial pleasant calming that occurs from taking refuge in seclusion and becoming mindful of the breath in the body. That again, the first jhana is simply the coming to meditation practice, sitting down, closing our eyes, becoming mindful of our breath in the body, and the enthusiasm that we bring with us. Rapture in this sense is not, it doesn't refer to the apocalypse. Rapture simply means a deep, joyful engagement with what we're doing. And in this case, it's a deep, joyful engagement with our meditation practice. That's the attitude that is best to carry into meditation practice, rather than, and sometimes this can happen, this almost a grudging defiance that I'm going to do it. I really don't like it. I don't enjoy it. But I'm going to do it because that crazy bald-headed guy said I should do it. We do it because we understand the benefits of it. And even if it's not there all the time, it's best to understand that what it means to take true refuge in what we're doing. We found something that can actually save our minds and save our lives. There should be some joyful enthusiasm there. Sariputta continues, furthermore, the ending of the defilements, greed, aversion, and deluded thinking are the defilements. And there's a great sutta, the Lesser Sutta on Dukkha, where the Buddha gets into that. And that's coming up. Coming attractions, I'm giving you. The ending of the defilements depends on the second jhana, which is the stilling of directed thought and evaluation. This second jhana is experienced as rapture and pleasure born of concentration. Free of directed thought and evaluation, the joy of concentration permeates the entire mind and body. So I would bet that every one of you has had this experience, and there's no time frame on this. In other words, you didn't not have an experience of the first jhana because it was fleeting, or the second jhana, or third, etc. They're simply there to be recognized. There's no time frame. And I would bet that every one of you has experienced this second jhana at some point or another, correct?
Yeah.
So you're doing it right. Permeates their entire mind and body. My comments here. The second jhana is a deepening awareness of the mind calming in the body as a point of concentration. Furthermore, the ending of the defilements depends on the third jhana, which is the fading of rapture. They remain equanimous, mindful, alert, sensitive to pleasure. With the fading of rapture, this pleasant abiding permeates their entire mind and body. My comments. This third jhana is characterized by the stilling of directed thought and evaluation, and now able to experience the subtle pleasure of a mind calmly united with the body. That's the third jhana. This is a pleasant abiding free of comparison to what is no longer present. In other words, you're simply present there. You're not thinking that, wow, I've really done something. I've progressed from this slightly distracted state here. Be present with what's occurring. That's the whole point of meditation. And as you've entered this third jhana, there's no longer directed thought. Directed thought and evaluation simply means just that. I'm directing my thought in a certain way, and I'm using that thought to judge, am I doing this right? Am I getting the benefits? Or anything else that might be occurring. Do I have the right cushion? Do I have the right, whatever it might be. All of those fall away when we enter the third jhana. And again, it might just be for the moment or two, but would every one of you have had experience of that? Of that evaluation? That's such a key experience to be mindful of, because it's that experience that we can take off our cushion and not evaluate, put a judgment on what's occurring in our life. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
It's a direct experience of right meditation. It's not something that magically happens to us. Furthermore, the ending of the defilements depends on the fourth jhana, which is the abandoning of evaluation. They enter and remain in the fourth jhana, which is pure equanimity and mindful. Being pure, neither pleasure nor pain is seen. They sit permeated mind and body with pure, bright awareness. The fourth jhana, which is a pleasant abiding. This is right meditation. So the culmination of the Buddha's Dhamma, of this world, to me, the world's greatest teaching, is a calm abiding. The problem with that is that a mind still rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths is still grasping after more experience. And a calm abiding is hardly enough, excuse me, to satisfy that type of mind. And that's the internal struggle that we all have to deal with in Dhamma practice. Glad you made it.
Thank you, Jeff.
See you, Brett. Because even within Dhamma practice, we can create this grasping after notion. The fourth jhana teaches us in meditation to get to that point of simply being at peace with life as life occurs. And then we can take that off our cushion and start integrating the rest of the Eightfold Path. We're almost done here, folks. I know it's a long sutta. This is a noble truth of the Eightfold Path of Practice that leads directly to the cessation of stress. Friends, it was here that the Tathagata set in motion the unexcelled wheel of Dhamma. The Dhamma cannot be corrupted by any Brahman, Deva, Mara, Brahma, or anyone in the entire world. No one can corrupt the revelation, the declaration, the description, the structure, the explanation, and the clear and direct teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And that's true. These teachings are still here in their pure form 2,600 years later. No one can corrupt them. They could try. This is what Venerable Sariputta said. Gratified, those in attendance were delighted with Venerable Sariputta's words. Thank you.
Ended where it began.
Yeah, yeah. What a wonderful sutta. It presents the Dhamma in an entirely clear and direct way. And so there's no ambiguity. And again, just to make the point, the whole point of what Sariputta teaches, the whole point of the Four Noble Truths, is to develop an understanding of what I truly am in relation to the world I live in. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, John. Thank you for this teaching. I'm going to take noble silence then.
Glad you're here. Good morning, Ron.
Morning. I read through this a few times, and now that you've spoken on it, I'm getting a bit better grasp now on the whole birth thing. That's always been one where I just go, okay, it could be this, it could be that, not quite clear on it, but this is... Because you're coming at it from so many different directions.
Yeah.
I'm getting a much better grasp on that now.
Thank you. It's a key. Kevin, could you crack the door a little bit?
Sure.
Stuffy in here. It is a key understanding. Let me continue. It was an important thing, but I kind of lost it, actually. Good morning, Anthony. I'll see you soon.
I had the observation when you read this that not only should we not take pain and suffering and conflict personally, but it's actually necessary. Because if everyone was always healthy, rich, and lived forever, nothing would ever change and no one would ever grow. There'd be no post-traumatic growth. There'd be no accomplishments, and you need to have the bad with the good. You need to struggle to be able to overcome, to be able to develop resilience, to be able to succeed in life. So it's, if you can look at it through that lens, it's not a Buddhist teaching, but I'm just saying, if you could look at it through that lens, you might not be so stressed out when things go wrong.
Thank you. And it is a Buddhist teaching. To understand that there's good and bad and none of it is personal. And to not strive for one or the other. The exposition and the declaration of this, when you think about it, you know, the setting, the first time these things were ever heard, the Buddha was the foremost radical of his time. In fact, there were plenty of death threats throughout the Pali Canon because he was so challenging the common beliefs of his time. And it still is that way, isn't it? And it's just a way of seeing the world realistically and our part in it, just like you described. Thank you. Thank you. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning, John. Oh, it's great to be here. Okay. I've always thought in terms of... good and bad, that, well, they say that you learn much more from what goes wrong than what goes right. And maybe you don't learn anything when things are right. Because then your brain kind of goes off into, you know, another level where you don't have to really think.
Yes.
When things are just kind of going along.
Well, you might, though. You know, most people would think how lucky they are. How, all these good things are happening to me.
Right.
Which is just as much of a deluded way of thinking. Again, the Dhamma teaches us to see all things as they are, the good and the bad. It's just a matter of having a human life. And it's not so much that we understand. The Buddha teaches, it's called via negativa, via the negative, shall pointing out. And why? Because from the beginning of time, we don't want to look at that part of our lives. And maybe that's why there's more of an opportunity to learn, because it's what we're trying to avoid. But the Buddha's teaching that it's all, when we're clinging to any of this, it's all a fabrication. It's all rooted in ignorance. So whether we're clinging to negative scenarios to learn from, or clinging to positive scenarios as reward from the things that we learned in the negative, it's all part of this one grand thing called dukkha, part of having a human life. And seeing it all in that impersonal way is what's important. But I understand what you and Anthony are saying. Most of us as human beings learn from the negative because that's what gets our attention. You know, that's what we notice. Just look at, it's a long class. Look at what's presented on the news today. And think of it this way. Does it have to be that way? Does the news have to be only about all the awful things that are happening in the world? And why is it?
Catches our attention.
But does it have to be that way?
No.
Do we need to know as much as possible every negative thing that's happening in the world? Why wouldn't we create a media situation that tells us about all the good things that are happening in the world? It might say that Cuba missed a hurricane last week. Isn't that wonderful for Cuba? But we don't, and because nobody would care. But that's just the way it is. And that's not right or wrong. It's just the nature of human life. We're consumed. We're distracted. We're preoccupied with stress and suffering. That's why it's such a great teacher, because that's what we focus on.
A lot of things on the news, that's right, I call it the disaster news, because that's all. And then they'll have 1 minute in the end of some wonderful thing that's happened.
Yeah.
You know, they save that for the last, and some joyful, wonderful thing. Now, here's an interesting thing. So, as I've gotten older, there are more things. Okay, maybe there's no good and bad, there's just things, but there's definitely more challenges in my life.
Yep.
And, finding this space here has just saved me in so many ways.
Yeah.
And been wonderful. So, all right, well, so here's wrong thought, or wrong speech, because I could say, oh, well, the universe was looking after me and sent me here. Okay, that's the opposite. That's the total opposite of Buddhist teachings. And, you know, that, like we talked about one time, it doesn't all come together for me. Things just happen, and they just are. And, you know, so it's getting away from it. So it's also learning that, wow, I found this in the nick of time. What a coincidence, or it's just be grateful that it is.
That's all.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, this is like, what's occurring right now.
The universe. Yeah. You know, like this book that we have it over. The universe has your back.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, again, that's magical way of looking at the world that is rooted in self-identification. In other words, the Buddha taught this 2,600 years ago, and it was preserved by hundreds and thousands of people, so that 2,600 years later, it can be here for me. I'm just glad that it is here for me.
Yeah,
I'll get to you more.
Yeah, I know.
Thank you. David, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm glad you're here. Mary, good to see you.
It's good to be here. Even though I've missed a lot of, you know, the lectures, because I've been living my life. And I think coming to these classes, by and large, has allowed me to live my life. More than I was living it still, when I hear the teachings, I've heard bits and pieces of these teachings, and it's always so great to hear them again, and I'm always so surprised, I don't know why I'm surprised, how relevant they still are, even in this day and age. And it also makes me think back on something I've always said to myself when things are going awry, this too shall pass. And what I need to do is realize, even when things are going well, this too shall pass.
Yeah.
And that's what it's all about. It's this is what's happening now, and 2 seconds later, that this won't be what's happening, and it is what it is.
It is. That's the Dhamma.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if you all of these classes now in this study are on one web page.
Okay.
On the home page, it says Vipassana Structured Study.
Okay.
And that has them all. If you want to catch up.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're here this morning. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, John. Thank you for bringing us the Dhamma, Buddhist Dhamma. You are our Sarvabhauma. We are delighted by your words.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it. Good morning, Jay.
Good morning to all. We've been all over the place today, and so I could comment on any number of things, but my comments aren't going to be anywhere near as good as the stuff you've been trying to pack into our little heads. So I think I understand about the 4 sucky afflictions, you know, that you got to get used to it. I think I got that. And, you know, like Mary says, I'm living my life. That's going down the Eightfold Path. Trying to cope with that, you know, or trying to integrate my mind, my body, the whole deal. That's all I got, John.
Thank you, Jay. Yeah, it's just that. It's just, I mean, that's the Dhamma. Integrate the Eightfold Path. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, John. Thank you, and noble silence.
Glad you're here. Good morning, Julia.
Good morning. I think that humans kind of have to, like, realize that, death, suffering, birth, then life and death are part of the laws of nature.
Yep.
And that being the laws of nature, that we're not special, that we're not the only ones that are going through the laws of nature. And we need to not take that personal. The thing that we have to realize is that we have the intellect, and this is why we have a lot of distractions, but we need to focus internal so that we can realize that our purpose here is to become awakened. And the only way to become awakened is by following the Eightfold Path.
Wow.
And so that's the conclusion that I came, the summary that came into my mind of this, this class today.
Yeah. Wow, that is perfect insight. It is just that. It's understanding. The reason why I've been thinking a certain way is because of lacking this particular understanding, and it's just that. And to see it is really significant, rather than get caught up in something else. Someone just came in?
Yes, I'm Mary.
Oh, I'll see you, Mary. I'm glad you're here this morning, Julia. Morning, Tim.
Morning. I'll just speak in a little
time. I'm glad you're here. Good morning, Maura. Why don't you come in the room?
I'm in the room.
Yeah, you're here.
It'll be the new room, I think.
Yeah, that's true.
There's a lot in there, so it's very clear. I agree with maybe what Mary had said a lot, but just it's just so clear, and there's so much in it. It's just such a direct path, and you have such that this sutta is just like you could just read this over and over and just stay there. Like it's got everything you need, and you can find out. I'm here. Woo! That's because I forgot. Like the description of right intention, right understanding, and then right intention again. Just so clear. So I'm truly really thankful to be here, and I think I heard you say it one of the other classes, and that was kind of what I was just going to add in as a reminder, because it's I think it's another kind of pith way of reducing suffering in the moment, is kind of like when Mary was saying, well, the universe brought me here and this might that, or establishing other realms. You talked, that was in the teachings today. And you said in one of the other classes, and this is always, I think, what the Buddha was saying, is that may be so, but that is just furthering fabrications. Like, I mean, like, so let go of that. It may be so, it may not be so, but is that bringing you closer to the goal of just awakening and being present with what is occurring right now? So maybe the universe did conspire to bring Jay, everybody here, myself. But that's this, and Buddha would say, let go of those thoughts, right? They're only bringing you suffering, clinging to, and they're born out of, you know, some crazy misunderstanding of the way things are. Like, just let go.
Abandoned. Yeah, and he taught that because they're fabricated abstractions. They're not even, again, the saying that they may be true is not saying they are true. It's simply saying you can't prove it, you can't experience it. So what good is it? And that's the radical difference between what the Buddha taught and most every belief system is based on something that is abstract. It's not possible to have an experience of it. But that's the point.
Yeah, I get it. I just don't always articulate it as clearly as you.
That's what I'm here for. You articulate it beautifully more. You always do. Amora really put the capper on what this is about. It's about experiencing our life as our life unfolds from the point of view of understanding what is going on. Mm-hmm. And the only way that I can understand what's going on is I have to understand. I have to understand the internal process that's interpreting that, and like that saying, "garbage in, garbage out." If what I'm interpreting is rooted in ignorance, anything that follows is rooted in ignorance. But if I'm seeing things clearly, meaning impersonally and dispassionately, then no matter what's occurring in my life, I'm maintaining a calm and peaceful mind, which is what I always wanted. I just didn't know how to get it. It's what we all want, really. We don't know how to go about getting it.
Right.
Now we do.
Dispassionately, based on an understanding of Four Noble Truths.
Yep.
Because we can view what's occurring impersonally and dispassionately, but almost from like a detached, ignorant view.
Yeah, that's quite different. Mm-hmm. That and some people get stuck in that.
Right.
That they taking this hard, almost aloof attitude. Nothing bothers me. Mm-hmm. You know. Well, that's not it. In fact, an awakened human being, I'll put it this way. The things that I feel now are much more intense than they ever were before. But they're also much more realistic. I probably cried more in the past 3 years than I ever did in my whole life. But it's not out of this wailing sorrow, it's just a deep connection with what's going on in the world, and sometimes it brings you to tears, doesn't it? But it's not this wailing, you know, how awful things are, people are. It's just a recognition of people suffering. People suffer. This having a human life, I don't care who you are, is tough. Not always, but it's tough. Suffering is inherent, and sometimes when it pops up, you know, what gets me is I don't even know how to describe it. Is people that are hit by incredible suffering that are unprepared for it, and I'm kind of formulating this as I'm saying it, which is a lot of life, but because you're lacking an understanding of life, you can't be prepared for a lot of things that happen, can you? Because you're not present, you're not understanding what's going on. An example might be the Bermuda hurricane and those types of things, but they happen all the time. You know, again, I don't want to get too deep into that and the note on suffering, because that's only an aspect of life. Meaning, stress and suffering is only one aspect of life, except if we attach ourselves to it in a way that it has to be a certain way. And then we're even taking the so-called good things in life and attaching a measure of suffering onto those. That's what I mean when you can't really see things clearly. But when you can, when it's appropriate, the Vatthakasanthana Sutta, the Buddha teaches you, you gain the ability to think what you want to think when you want to think it. What an incredible thing, which means that in the moment, what I'm thinking or what I'm feeling is entirely appropriate for what's occurring. There's nothing personal about it. What great relief. Sorry for going on today. Rather long class, but it was a great and important class. Is there any other questions or comments before I finish with metta, as we always do? Okay. And next Tuesday's class is on the Maghavabhanga Sutta, which is an analysis of the Eightfold Path. So it just it follows right into this, and it's a clear teaching on this path that we're developing. So, all right, we'll finish with metta, as we always do. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So again, just take a moment to become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And again, these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.